Iran. I don't think they're going to employ that sort of tit for tat. They're not going to go and kill Israeli children either. It's much more likely, maybe this is a little wishful thinking, but I think it's much more likely they're going to do something far more targeted, as indeed the resistance forces have been doing already. In other words, that they attack airfields, Israeli Air Force, army bases, for example. They're able to do that. We saw that with them, and this is the only precedent we really have, is the after the murder of Commander Soleimani, the attack on the Ayn al-Assad air base in Iraq, when they sent in some missiles, but gave some warning and allowed the North Americans to escape from that scenario. But at least it was a very powerful blow and a demonstration of force there. I suspect that the attacks being lined up will be against the Israeli military, which after all are the ones that have been committing crimes in Gaza, and most of the international community would applaud such a blow.
Well, Tim, we saw last week how the Israeli occupation army announced in a statement the intensification of a reserve recruitment for their air defense systems and the cancellation of the leaves for their occupation army soldiers in several of the military units during this current week, as they actually take out their brigades and units from Gaza, and they are not allowing them to go back home as well. We also know for sure that Iran will retaliate. This is what Iran, from the highest leadership to the public who demonstrated against these assassinations, demanded and required. How likely do you think this current tension will escalate into an all-out regional war if it happens?
Yes, I think you're right that the Iranian leadership and the military have committed themselves to retaliation. I think maybe there's some surprise and apprehension around the world by the fact that it hasn't happened immediately. That really simply says that they're considering it very carefully and they're not being rushed, and they're playing to the line that they've always said is, we're going to do it on our own terms, in our own time. We're not going to be rushed or provoked into it. That's what the Israeli leadership has been trying to do, of course, has been trying to provoke Iran into a response, a heavy response, which, of course, the Israelis are probably going to regret. Because Iran has tremendous capacity to deliver a missile strike on very clear targets in occupied Palestine. In other words, they've got very fast ultrasonic missiles, and they're very targeted. So I think that the Israelis will regret inviting this. But the point of it is, and I think most analysts are agreeing on this, is that the Israelis are the one group in the region which wants escalation. They want the US in to support them, because they don't want to take on Iran by themselves. They couldn't do that at all. Whereas most of the other forces, to some extent the US, certainly Iran, even Hezbollah, which has been very targeted in its attacks there, have been trying to avoid escalation. Escalation is not going to be in favor of the civilians in the region at all, and escalation always introduces a level of uncertainty into things. No one knows how far it's going to go. So I think that there's always a risk of that escalation, and Iran is preparing for that, obviously, by the mobilization of air defenses there at the moment. Even the Russians have moved some forces down into the Syrian part of the unoccupied part of Syrian Jolan. The Israelis are panicking, really. There are many civilians are leaving the country. Of course, their army is mobilizing them, but there's not much that they can do except sit in anxiety, or what's the expression in Lebanon, stand on one leg, basically waiting for that response to come. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, that is a discipline in itself, really. I don't know exactly to what extent the Iranian threat is now affecting the remobilization of forces, the withdrawal of forces from Gaza, and some say it's because they're being remobilized for an assault on Rafah, but that's not clear as yet either. I think they're more concerned about Iran's response at the moment than the next step. Having said that, of course, Netanyahu is committed to another stage in Gaza, because as soon as this war is over, he's finished, really. Mm-hmm. Everyone knows that.
Well, Tim, it is no secret that the Zionist Israelis seek, with obviously a green light from the United States of America, to engage in a war of attrition with the Al-Quds force of the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps and gradually eliminate its leaders, the way that we've been seeing how they were conducting these assassination operations. Now, will this anticipated Iranian retaliatory attack, which you spoke extensively about, it might be in a way that it contains Zionist Zionist Israel rather than escalates the show in West Asia. Would it be enough, though, to deter, in your opinion, to deter any further attempt for Zionist Israel to further assassinate high-level IRGC commanders?
I don't, and it depends on the extent of the attack. In itself, it may not, but it depends how far Iran goes. Of course, we have other forces. We have the Iraqi resistance, the Yemeni resistance, the Lebanese resistance. The Iraqi resistance, I believe, has already carried out some strikes on oil refineries in Haifa. They've been attacking airfields before that. So in combination with those, the Iranian strikes, it depends on the extent of it, to which extent it's going to cripple the Israelis. I think they'll want to respond if they survive, or the extent of them that survives after this. But let's remember, the Israeli military is already seriously crippled after the resistance attacks from Gaza. Basically, they're relying on their international support. And that's, of course, the factor at play here. You know, to what extent are the Israelis going to be successful in drawing in outside support here to try and stave off being entirely crushed by resistance forces there? That's not entirely clear yet. I think it depends how extensive this, as the Iranian leader called it, the slap that's going to be delivered to the Israelis. I think a lot of us are hanging in anticipation to see how far this is going to go. And already, of course, it's having an impact on the Israelis, that they are bracing for it, and they are probably unlikely to launch a major new initiative in Gaza when this is still hanging over their heads.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Tim Anderson, professor from Sydney and academic author and geopolitical analyst, thanks a million for being with us to discuss this very pressing issue at the moment. And our hearts obviously go out to our brothers and sisters in Gaza, hoping for an imminent ceasefire for them. Ladies and gents, you can find Professor Tim Anderson on Twitter and on Telegram. You can follow him on Twitter at TimAnd2037. And you can find links to his books, especially about West Asia, very important knowledge that he is trying to educate the masses on, especially the Western masses. Thanks a million, Professor Tim Anderson. Now, ladies and gents, stay tuned, because next we are going to talk about how Israel is trying to drag the United States of America into an all war with Iran.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
The United States and Zionist Israel are attempting to drag Iran into a regional war against the backdrop of the genocide in Gaza. The occupation entity refuses to take responsibility for the attack on the Iranian consulate in Damascus, which Tehran also blames on the United States of America. More details in the following report.
The Israeli occupation continues its relentless onslaught on Gaza, trapped in a vicious cycle amid increasing pressures and challenges from all sides. While U.S. pressures on the entity remain more rhetoric than action, the overall international climate is gradually shifting towards opposition to Zionist Israel's atrocities in its war on Gaza with each passing day. The last cycle Zionist Israel willfully dragged itself into is the Israeli enemy targeting of the Iranian consulate building in Damascus. This aggression represents the most dangerous escalation in the region since the Al-Aqsa flood. This strike will undoubtedly alter the calibrated rules of engagement largely observed by the axis of resistance in dealing with the significantly increasing Zionist provocations. However, these rules will inevitably change, especially as they are a reflection of developments on the ground. Despite the fact that the United States and Zionist Israel are attempting to drag Iran into a regional war against the backdrop of the genocide in Gaza, the strategic vision of the resistance axis can be summarized as attempting to avoid open confrontation with the Zionist entity at present, while preparing for the inevitable major battle with an enemy that only understands the language of strength. However, exercising restraint, or what we might call strategic patience, also has its limits and boundaries that must not be crossed. This means that patients cannot be extended to actions that compromise the dignity of the Islamic Republic of Iran. The attack on the Iranian consulate carries various political messages. It is akin to a direct assault on Iranian territory, as diplomatic premises are considered part of the state's territory according to the theory of territorial extension. Moreover, it constitutes a clear violation of international law, which Zionist Israel has consistently disregarded, believing that might makes right on the ground. Well, it doesn't. Just as Iran acted prudently in response to the assassination of martyr Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani by the United States, it will do the same this time. Iran will not play into Zionist Israel's hands. Zionists want Iran's reaction to be in their favor, but the Islamic Republic of Iran will act with wisdom and rationality as it did during the past 6 months of the war on Gaza. Iran's response will be crafted so as not to give the Zionists a pretext for escalating the conflict. In the meantime, American and Zionist officials have been repeating that the Biden administration and the Israeli regime are extremely concerned that Iran is preparing for what they call an imminent attack, deliberately not mentioning it is merely a retaliation to the Zionist aggression on the consulate. U.S. website Axios even reported, citing Israeli entity officials, that Tel Aviv informed Washington that if Iran launches an attack on them from its territory in retaliation for the attack on its consulate in Syria, then it will face a strong Zionist response, and that will escalate the current conflict to a higher level. Well, we'll see soon if Zionist Israel will put its actions where its mouth is.
To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Mohammad Gharawi, political analyst. Thanks a million for being with us, Mr. Mohammad. Now, according to the Axios website, Tel Aviv told Washington that Iran will face a strong Israeli response which will escalate the current conflict to a higher level. Now, if Iran launches an attack on Zionist Israel from its own territories in retaliation to the assassination of the IRGC commanders in its consulate in Syria, is this a way of telling the United States of America that Zionist Israel will for sure drag Washington into an open war with Iran very soon?
It is clear that the United States will not yield to what Netanyahu specifically seeks. I believe Netanyahu, in his aggression towards Damascus, tried to tell the world and the United States to save him because he is in real trouble. He is in trouble in the West Bank, Gaza, and in the occupied Palestinian territories. So, I think with this strike, Zionist Israel was telling the United States to come forth and find a solution to the predicament he's facing at this stage. Netanyahu meant to say, if you don't agree to the solution, then I'm going to escalate. Here, I am going and attacking the Iranian consulate in Damascus. Netanyahu is now under extreme pressure socially, politically, and militarily, both internally and from the occupation army, which is currently under extreme military and security pressure. So, in my personal opinion, this strike is the end of the war, not the beginning of it. If the Americans realistically now agree to enter into negotiations and put unprecedented pressure on Netanyahu, I believe things are heading towards a solution and de-escalation in the Gaza Strip. And if this happens, I believe that through the visits of the Iranian Foreign Minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, whether to Oman, Damascus, or Beirut, Iran is conveying messages to the American side through mediators that Iran is ready to consider at the moment postponing this retaliatory operation or revenge, call it what you will. But I believe Iran is ready to engage in negotiations in exchange for the resistance factions achieving everything they want on the negotiating table, and for there to be a decisive agreement for a complete ceasefire and the return of the displaced to their homes in the Gaza Strip.
Well, Mr. Mohammad, everyone is talking about the possibility of escalating the war into a regional one, but no one is actually talking about the possibility that Zionists might actually hold Netanyahu fully responsible and choose to oust him instead of going into an all-out war against the Islamic Republic of Iran when they know that Netanyahu is just trying to pick a fight with Iran in order to save his face when it comes to the day after in Gaza. How plausible do you think this specific scenario is?
I don't believe Netanyahu has the capacity, neither the security, nor political, nor the societal margins, to engage in such a war with Iran. I think this exhausted occupation army can't afford to enter into new wars. The weary Zionist society can't bear any more pressure either. The colonial settlers in the north and around Gaza are also fed up. All of this constitutes significant pressure. This is besides the pressing issue of the Zionist captives, which Netanyahu cannot dodge or maneuver around. I believe all the parties that stood by Netanyahu in his war on Gaza are tired and fed up with the lack of solution and goals in Gaza. The U.S. administration, under President Biden, and the European countries, all those who are defending Netanyahu now because of his actions in Damascus, can no longer stand by Netanyahu legally or politically in this matter. So, everyone is tired of this situation and this stalemate. So I believe everyone is pushing Netanyahu towards a solution. And no one will assist Netanyahu if he wants to go into a broad and comprehensive war against Iran. It's clear if there's a war on Iran, these fires will spread throughout the region and not remain limited to Iranian soil. So, no one is ready to enter into a new war after 3 years of the war in Ukraine. The global economy won't allow it, and the exhausted American economy won't allow it either. The Americans, who are preparing for upcoming elections, are in a situation that doesn't allow them to be dragged into such a war with Netanyahu. So, I believe even the Americans are not prepared to let Netanyahu engage in such a reckless war against Iran in this context.
Well, there's something that I really find a bit interesting to discuss, which is the demonization of Iran and its role in the region that emerged after the success of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, which declared absolute hostility towards the United States of America and Zionist Israel. Now, this perspective has proven itself over time, bringing us back to those who are always doubting and skeptical about the role of Iran in the region. It's supposed to be a source of strength, especially for those specific Arabs who doubt the role of Iran, and not the other way around, considering that our enemy has become mutual and Iran is among the most enthusiastic in confronting it. And by doing so, it is helping the resistance in the region. Then why is it actually the other way around? Why is this hostility and demonization against the Islamic Republic of Iran?
I believe the Al-Aqsa flood and its aftermath, along with many other issues in the region, such as normalization and whatnot, have made things more transparent. The Islamic Republic now has more cards of power to say to all the collaborators, peoples, rulers, and countries, especially Arab and Islamic ones, here is Zionist Israel, with whom you have gone far in friendship, and in return, you have gone far in demonizing us Iranians in this context. Here is Zionist Israel, killing without restraint, displacing and destroying homes, hospitals, children and women. I believe what happened may have been beneficial to the stance taken by Iran and the axis of resistance towards this Israeli entity. Now, no one can say that this Israeli entity is carrying the flag of peace in this region. The flag of peace is not raised by committing massacres, arresting civilians, and burning hospitals and schools, as we saw in Gaza. I believe what happened constitutes a power card for Iran's position, its strategy, and its view towards the Israeli occupation entity. And this will naturally impact not only the peoples of this region, but also the global public opinion. The global public opinion now knows more about the Palestinian cause and knows who stands on the side of right and justice, and conversely, who is wrong and who is the oppressor and killer. I believe what we are seeing now in Europe, America, and in many countries of the world towards Zionist Israel, and this hostile or at least unsatisfied view with what is happening in Gaza. This strengthens Iran's position, reinforces Iran's power in presenting its strategy and vision towards the issues of the region, especially the Palestinian cause. This deepens further the position that Imam Khomeini portrayed after the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, by saying that Zionist Israel is a cancerous gland. Now everyone is probing this cancerous gland in this region for its impact on the peoples of the region and its neighbors. No one is comfortable in this region because they have come to believe that the Israeli entity constitutes a source of concern for them. And this Israeli entity is dragging the Americans into channels which the U.S. would rather stay away from in this regard.
هو في حل منها في هذا الإطار.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Mohammed Ghadawi, geopolitical analyst, thanks a million for being with us to discuss this issue about how Zionist Israel is trying to drag the United States of America into an all-out open war with the Islamic Republic of Iran, but it's obviously unable to do so until this moment. Thanks a million for being with us. Now, ladies and gents, thank you, and Eid Mubarak to you, to your families, and especially to our brothers and sisters in occupied Palestine, namely those in Gaza, who have been killed, who have been displaced, who have lost their lives and their loved ones because of the Zionist Israeli genocidal tendencies to showing the world that it doesn't care about other human beings. Anyways, Eid Mubarak to you. We'll see you again next week. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, reciting the Holy Quran as an integral part of our Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, such an honor to be here at your service, A to Z. So we're talking about Islamic lifestyle. Now, of course, one of the things that is really important part of our Islamic lifestyle is this recitation of the Holy Quran. And so, you know, as we continue to move farther and farther away from the holy month of Ramadan, we should be able to continue the things that we had started in the holy month of Ramadan throughout the rest of our Islamic lifestyle. So, of course, reciting the Holy Quran was something which was regularly done in that month. And so now, you know, in the month of Shawwal, and of course, you know, these few first days, if you will, that we are born again, our sins, inshallah, have been forgiven, we are pure, we are clean. And so it is in this kind of a situation that we need to make sure we continue this Ramadan lifestyle, this Islamic lifestyle. You know, and the farther we get away from the holy month of Ramadan, the more we're going to start to kind of lose certain small pieces as we move forward, right? So reciting the Holy Quran, it was something that we were doing on a regular basis. And this is what's really important, is to be able to continue that recitation of the Holy Quran. You know, one of the things that we felt in the holy month of Ramadan was how reciting the Holy Quran has this purifying effect. And so, you know, now that we are moving on, and, you know, the different problems and aspects and difficulties and challenges that life has and that we are faced with in our life, we really need this purity and this spirituality. And this is one of the ways in which we can attain that purity and spirituality, and really continue to keep us pure as we move forward. And that is the recitation of the word of Allah, the Holy Quran. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about reciting the Holy Quran as an integral part of our Islamic lifestyle. You know, we were reciting the Holy Quran in the holy month of Ramadan. And so, you know, we kind of, that begs the question, is why can't we do it now that we are past the holy month of Ramadan, right? One of the things is that we need to kind of, you know, schedule and manage our time in a manner where at a specific time we want to allot for the recitation of the Holy Quran, right? You know, we talked about in the previous segment how reciting the Holy Quran itself is a type of purifier, just merely reciting it. But of course, merely reciting it is not the end goal, right? We should read the translation, we should try to understand the Arabic, we should kind of contemplate for a minute or two, at the least, about the verse that we have written. So perhaps maybe every day at a specific time, inshallah, we want to spend, you know, like 4 minutes or 5 minutes, recite, at least one verse of the Holy Quran, and start to make it an integral part of our Islamic lifestyle that we are continuing, right, from our Ramadan lifestyle. And inshallah, this recitation of the Holy Quran is going to definitely bring barakah and blessings from the Almighty Allah, and it will eventually become a very integral part of our Islamic lifestyle.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio.
The limelight.
In the United States, the special counsel Jack Smith has pressed the U.S. Supreme Court to reject Donald Trump's claim that he's immune from criminal prosecution for attempting to overturn the results of the 2020 election. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Special counsel Jack Smith urged the Supreme Court on Monday, 8th of April, to reject former President Donald Trump's claim that he's entitled to sweeping immunity from federal prosecution, arguing that the former president's alleged efforts to overturn the results of the 2020 election frustrates core constitutional provisions that protect democracy. In a court filing to the Supreme Court, Jack Smith and his team of prosecutors argued that Donald Trump asserts a novel and sweeping immunity from the criminal laws that all citizens must abide by, and said his alleged scheme to thwart the transfer of presidential power was outside the duties of his office. No presidential power at issue in this case entitles the president to claim immunity from the general federal criminal prohibitions supporting the charges. Fraud against the United States, obstruction of official proceedings, and denial of the right to vote, they wrote. The president's constitutional duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed does not entail a general right to violate them. The special counsel told the justices that there are layered safeguards when a criminal case is brought that provide assurance that prosecutions will be screened under rigorous standards and that no president need be chilled in fulfilling his responsibilities by the understanding that he is subject to prosecution if he commits federal crimes. He also argued that there is no evidence that Congress intended to exempt the president from federal criminal statutes. Jack Smith's filing lays out the arguments his office will make before the Supreme Court justices on 25th of April, when they convene to weigh Donald Trump's bid to bring an end to his federal prosecution in Washington, D.C. Trump submitted his opening brief last month, in which he urged the Supreme Court to find that former presidents are entitled to broad protections from criminal prosecutions for acts taken whilst in office. From 1789 to 2023, no former or current president faced criminal charges for his office acts, for good reason, Trump's lawyers argued in the court. The president cannot function, and the presidency itself cannot retain its vital independence if the president faces criminal prosecution for official acts once he leaves office. But in his filing to the court, the special counsel Jack Smith wrote, "The federal criminal law applies to the president," and called Trump's argument to the contrary a radical suggestion. The absence of any prosecutions of former presidents until this case does not reflect understanding that presidents are immune from criminal liability. It instead underscores the unprecedented nature of petitioners' alleged conduct, Jack Smith argued. Notably, prosecutors wrote that even if the High Court were to find that some immunity could be extended to a former president's official acts whilst in office, that would not preclude Donald Trump's prosecution. According to Jack Smith and his team, the allegations against Trump deal with private scheme with private actors to achieve a private end, petitioners' efforts to remain in power by fraud. The special counsel told the court that the alleged plan to overturn the outcome of the presidential election in 2020 is the paradigmatic example of conduct that should not be immunized, even if other conduct should be. The High Court is reviewing a ruling from a 3-judge panel under Federal Appeals Court in Washington that found Donald Trump can be prosecuted for alleged attempts to thwart the transfer of presidential power after the 2020 election. The former president was charged last August with 4 counts relating to accusations he acted unlawfully in a bid to stay in office, and he has pleaded not guilty. A trial in the case before U.S. District Judge Tanya Chutkan was initially scheduled to begin last month, but proceedings have been paused since December, as Donald Trump pursues appeals on the immunity matter. The case marks the first time the Supreme Court will consider whether a former president is immune from criminal liability for allegedly illegal acts committed whilst in office. It has in the past, though, found presidents are shielded from civil lawsuits stemming from conduct within the outer perimeter of their official duties. The question before the Supreme Court justices in the case concerning Trump is whether, and if so, to what extent does a former president enjoy presidential immunity from criminal prosecution for conduct alleged to involve official acts during his tenure in office? Though the phrasing of the question indicates that the Supreme Court may not consider Donald Trump's argument that a former president can only be prosecuted if he's first impeached by the House and acquitted by the Senate, both Trump and Jack Smith addressed the assertion. Jack Smith told the court in his filing that the Constitution doesn't establish a rule requiring such action by Congress before a former president can be prosecuted. Jack Smith wrote, "Adopting Donald Trump's position would thwart the ordinary application of criminal law simply because Congress, in administering the political process of impeachment, did not see fit to impeach or to convict." The American newspaper The Daily Beast has also covered the same story. Special Counsel Jack Smith on Monday, 8th of April, pressed the U.S. Supreme Court to reject Donald Trump's claim that he's immune from criminal prosecution for attempting to overturn the results of the 2020 election. The special counsel's assertion that no person is above the law, including the president, was backed up in supplementary filings by retired military officials and former Republican lawmakers. In a friend of the court brief, a group of 19 retired four-star U.S. military generals and other retired high-ranking military officials called Donald Trump's argument contrary to the foundational principles of our democracy. They warned that a ruling in Donald Trump's favor would undermine a president's legal and moral authority to command military forces, as it would signal that they, but not he, must obey the rule of law. It would also, they said, threaten to inject chaos into military operations, as well as peaceful presidential transfers of power. The notion of such immunity, both as a general matter and also specifically in the context of the potential negation of election results, threatens to jeopardize our nation's security and international leadership, they said. Particularly in times like the present, when anti-democratic authoritarian regimes are on the rise throughout the world, such a threat is intolerable and dangerous. In another amicus brief, 13 former appointed and elected officials, including former representatives Tom Campbell, Republican of California, and Tom Coleman, Republican of Missouri, and former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld, also a Republican, argued that siding against Jack Smith could encourage disgruntled future presidents to weaponize the military and other armed federal personnel to reverse election results that they didn't like. In their 66-page filing, Jack Smith prosecutors told the High Court that Donald Trump's novel and sweeping clutch for absolute immunity was not supported by any constitutional text, history, precedent, or policy considerations.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Well, we're going to talk about some of the jurisprudential laws related to enjoining the good and forbidding the evil, based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Well, let me start with this question, Sheikh. What's the rule if enjoining the good and forbidding the evil compromises the dignity of someone who fails to carry out an obligatory act or perpetuates a prohibited act and humiliates him before or in front of the people?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, enjoining the good and forbidding evil have certain conditions which must be fulfilled in order for a person to be able to fulfill this duty. In some cases, it becomes obligatory, and some cases, of course, when the conditions are not met, one is not supposed to engage in enjoining good and forbidding evil because it might have its negative consequences. So we have to look at the consequences or whether enjoining the good and forbidding evil has it is the desired impact or not. In the event that it will have its impact, of course, we have to do it. Now, when it comes to compromising the dignity of someone, of course, if one observes the condition and etiquette of enjoining the good and forbidding evil and does not transgress the limits, there is no problem, and one should do so because Amr bil Ma'ruf and Nahi anil Munkar are obligatory duties which one should fulfill when it does not compromise, of course, on someone's dignity and esteem.
I see. Okay, well, Sheikh, is it a governmental ordinance or a fatwa that under the Islamic State that, that the people's duty with respect to enjoining the good and forbidding the evil is limited to oral enjoining and forbidding? And the other grades, of course, are the responsibility of the authorities?
Well, according to His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, of course, it is a fatwa, it is a jurisprudential fatwa, that every individual should engage in enjoining the good and forbidding the evil, in promoting virtue and preventing evil. This is a duty which everyone has to fulfill when the conditions are propitious and when the situation is ripe.
I see. Okay, thank you very much. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to forbidding, enjoining the good and forbidding the evil. Well, Sheikh Javed, if forbidding evil with respect to, without the permission of the ruler, is it permissible without the permission of the ruler when, stopping someone from perpetuating evil depends on something like, for example, hitting that individual or imprisoning that individual or person or putting him or her to hardship, or on entering in, using, for example, that individual's properties, even if it is or it leads to their destruction?
Well, in the existence of an Islamic government or an Islamic establishment, these duties are the duties of an Islamic government. Because individuals cannot take the law in their hands and carry out these, for example, acts of prisoning and in hitting some people, because one should not exceed one's limits in enjoining good and forbidding evil. So for enjoining good and forbidding evil are oral acts in terms of the individual obligation. But when one is required to, for example, to hit someone or imprison someone because of the crimes they commit, because of the felonies they perpetrate, then it becomes the duty of the government and the government authorities to take action to stop someone from committing and perpetrating crimes. Because otherwise, if every individual takes action to hit someone, to imprison someone, or to carry out such things, there will be chaos, there will be lawlessness, and there will be mayhem, and that's not in the interest of the Islamic society.
Mm-hmm. If forbidden evil with respect to very important matters, such as protecting the life of a respected person, in other words, to exclude the life of a murderer and the like, cannot be performed except through violence, such as hitting, which may cause injury or occasionally even killing of the assailant, will the permission of the authorized religious authority be required?
Well, if saving someone's life, you know, someone's life, I mean the life of a person who is respected, who is Muslim, who is mu'min, you know, and of course, and if preventing murder depends on immediate and direct intervention, it is quite permissible for that individual to go ahead. And it even becomes obligatory according to Islamic law, because if he does not jump into action to prevent someone or to protect someone's life, then that probably that when the death occurs, then the religion does not consent to mm-hmm. that. The religion tells you to stop committing to prevent someone from committing such a grave and such a heinous crime, committing murder, which is a grave crime. And of course, the Holy Quran explicitly says that killing someone is equal to killing in the entire humanity. So it is necessary to take immediate action to stop someone from killing someone else.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us.
اللهم صل على سيدنا ونبينا محمد وآله.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Rahat, hosting this program. Ashley Chavid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to forbidding, enjoining the good and forbidding evil. Sheikh Chavid, is it obligatory for someone who wants to enjoin another person to the good and forbids him from evil to have a special power to carry it out? When is it basically obligatory to enjoin the good and forbid the evil?
Well, first of all, it's important for the person enjoining good and forbidding evil to have good understanding of what is evil and what is good. Because unless you do not know what evil is
mm-hmm.
and what good is, I think you will not be able to promote it, to promote good, to promote virtue, and to prevent evil.
So knowledge is first.
Knowledge is important. So whoever enjoins and forbids actually must know what the good and evil are, and he should know that that the wrongdoer actually commits the wrong actions intentionally and without any, for example, legal excuse. So in that case, of course, if it becomes kind of obligatory to enjoin the good and forbid evil, when of course it's likely that enjoining good has its effect
mm-hmm.
and when you are you yourself as in someone who is enjoining is you are secure from any kind of danger, because enjoining good should not involve any danger or it shouldn't entail any kind of harm for the person himself, because if it entails such a thing, then it's no longer obligatory to enjoin the good and forbid the evil.
I see. So first of all, you talked about knowledge and then power.
Power is necessary, and then the effect of the enjoining and
if
there is
no effect, or you expect no effect to be on the person who you enjoin to the good and forbid from evil,
then
it doesn't become necessary or obligatory.
And then also you yourself should be safe from any harm, because the other party who is prevented from from evil,
I see,
should not attack you or cause any harm on you.
If someone like a relative, a close friend, continually commits sins, what should we do regarding our relationship with that individual?
Well, such people who commit felonies, they are sometimes good people, okay? And if you think that cutting relations may make your relative, your friend or relative, refrain from these sins, it will be obligatory for you to do so, to stay away from such people, to cut off or break off with them.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a way of enjoining the good and forbidding evil.
So if they become very much upset and take offense, what should we do? Should we still enjoin the good or forbid him from evil?
Well, this may be a natural consequence of enjoining someone and forbidding someone from evil. Because if you tell someone not to do it, he might take offense.
Yes.
So you don't have to care about it, because you are doing your duty and you don't know what is going on in his mind. Many people take offense, but we should do our duty of enjoining the good and forbidding evil. But when I want to tell another thing, and that is, we should not break off or break our ties with our kins and close relatives, like our parents, our children, our brothers and sisters, when enjoying the good. Okay. Mm-hmm. Because Sila Rahim, which means maintaining relationship, keeping ties with our close relatives, is a duty. It's an act of virtue. We cannot, for example, skip one act of virtue for another, you know. So all of them are obligatory. But when it comes to close relatives, of course, we should not break ties with them.
Mm-hmm, I see. Thank you very much, Mr. Reed. Thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, in which we try to deal with some of the jurisprudential laws related to enjoining the good and forbidding the evil. Thank you. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم ملجا لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.